This is a Power Broadcast program. More information at powerbroadcast.com.
We're here to give you that shortcut to understanding the foundational limits of the digital world that we all, you know, live in.
And today we're focusing on one person whose work really set those limits, Alan Turing. History, and rightly so, celebrates him for his role in World War II at Bletchley Park.
Oh, absolutely. The Enigma machine, the fish ciphers. That work was crucial.
It really was. I mean, it's credited with shortening the war by years, saving countless lives, just revolutionary stuff in signal security.
But the thing that's so incredible, and what we're diving into today, is that the real foundation for all of modern computer science. He laid that before the war even started.
In 1935, he was, what, 22 years old? It's almost impossible to imagine. He published this paper that defined the fundamental logical structure of every single stored program digital computer we use.
Right. And that theory didn't just tell us what computation is. More importantly, it told us what computation could never be.
Exactly. So this deep dive is all about those bedrock concepts. We're talking about the Turing machine, the Church-Turing thesis, and then these monumental, almost terrifying discoveries about what's called undecidability.
The halting problem and the enchidings problem.
That's right.
And these aren't just, you know, dusty old theories. They are the immutable laws of how information gets processed. So our mission here is to unpack all of this, to give you a really clear, powerful handle on the mathematical constraints that govern computer science, and critically, what that means for things like AI, our universe, and maybe even the human mind itself.
So let's get into it.
Okay, let's unpack this. So to get to the limits, we first have to understand the machine itself, the Turing machine, or TM. What was the central question Turing was trying to answer back in 35 when he dreamed this thing up?
Well, he was wrestling with this really deep problem that mathematicians were obsessed with at the time, this whole thing about formalizing all of mathematics, Hilbert's program. And Turing's approach was deceptively simple. He just asked, can a machine, you know, following a set of simple instructions, perform any computation that a human mathematician could?
A human computer, as they were called back then.
Exactly. He needed a really rigorous universal definition of what an algorithm or an effective procedure actually was.
So the Turing machine was never meant to be a physical device. It was a model, an abstraction that he built by basically watching a human calculate. Can you help us visualize that analogy?
Yeah, that analogy is everything. It's the whole foundation. He built this abstract model by meticulously analyzing what a human does. And this is the key part, the inherent limitations of that human agent when they're carrying out a calculation.
Like a clerk just sitting at a desk with a long piece of paper.
That's the perfect image. And so what are those limitations?
Okay, what did Turing have to account for?
First, a human has finite memory. You can only keep so much in your head at once. In the model, that's the tape. It's infinite in theory, but at any given time, only a finite part of it has anything written on it.
All right. And you can only look at a small piece of it at a time.
That's the second limit, finite observation. Turing said there's some bound, let's call it B, to the number of squares or symbols you can observe at one moment. If you need to see more, you have to do it in separate steps, successive observations.
Okay, so limited focus, limited working memory. What about the human's internal state, their state of mind?
That's the third constraint, and maybe the most fascinating one. He said there has to be a finite number of states of mind. He called them mem configurations.
Mem configurations. That's such a great term. It's so of its time. Logic meets psychology.
It is. And he insisted this set of states had to be finite. If you allowed an infinity of mental states, the whole process would break down, become non-deterministic. Some states would be so close to each other you couldn't tell them apart, and it would create ambiguity.
But wait, human thought feels so complex, so nuanced. How did Turing get away with limiting the number of internal states?
Well, this is the genius of it. This is the central trick. Turing realized that if you needed a more complicated state of mind for a calculation, you didn't need a new mental state. You could just offload that complexity.
Out of the tape.
Exactly. You avoid needing a new M configuration by simply writing more symbols on the tape to act as reminders or, you know, little notes to yourself. The complexity moves from the mind, the finite states, onto the paper, the tape.
I see. So the tape isn't just memory. It's a way for this very simple, limited processor to handle basically infinite complexity.
Precisely. And that dictates the actions. The machine's operations have to be incredibly simple. So simple, you can't break them down any further.
Like what?
It either prints a symbol, erases a symbol, or moves one square left or right. And in any single step, only one symbol can be changed. That's it.
Which brings us to the formal definition. He called it the automatic machine, or a machine. What's the automatic part mean?
It all comes down to what he called the determinacy condition. The machine's behavior is completely 100% determined at every moment by just two things. Its current state, its M configuration, and the symbol it's currently looking at on the tape.
And the program is just a lookup table that says, if you're in state X and you see symbol Y, do this.
Yes, that's all it is. It requires zero ingenuity. Zero intuition. It's just pure mechanical rule following. And that's what made it different from what he called a C machine, a choice machine.
Choice machine would need a person to step in.
Yeah, it would require some external human intervention if it got to a point where multiple rules could apply. Turing's whole quest was to define calculation purely in terms of the A machine, the fully deterministic mechanism.
And that simple constrained set of rules is what let him prove these huge theorems about the limits of all computation.
That's the power of it. #... 1.2 the Universal Turing Machine, UTM.
So, okay, we have the basic TM, which is designed to solve one specific problem. But the next leap to the Universal Turing Machine, the UTM, that's where Turing really defines the modern computer.
Oh, absolutely. This is the conceptual jump that makes the entire digital age possible. I mean, think about it. Before the UTM, if you wanted a machine to calculate, say, ballistic trajectories, you built a trajectory calculator.
And if you wanted one to factor numbers, you built a whole separate factoring machine.
Right. The UTM was the proof that you didn't need specialized hardware for every single task.
So how does it do that? How does the UTM get this universal power?
Well, the UTM is designed to compute any computable sequence.
Yeah.
And it does that because its input is basically in two parts. First, it gets what's called a standard description, the SD.
Which is the program.
It's essentially the code. It's the complete rule set of any other specific Turing machine, let's call it machine M, written out on its tape. And then second, it gets the data that you wanted machine M to process in the first place.
So the UTM reads the description of machine M, and then it just pretends to be M. It simulates it step by step on the data.
That's exactly it. The UTM is an emulator. It's one single fixed piece of theoretical hardware that can do the job of any possible TM you can imagine just by reading the instructions, the software, for that machine.
And that immediately gives you the whole idea of the stored program computer, the separation of the logic, the program, from the device, the UTM.
It's the core principle of interchangeability. It's the reason you can use the exact same laptop to run a massive physics simulation 1 minute and then stream a movie the next. That's the UTM principle in the real world.
And people like John von Neumann saw this right away.
They did. He incorporated that stored program concept into what we now call the von Neumann architecture, which is the blueprint for pretty much every conventional computer built today. The UTM is the theoretical ancestor of all of it.
Okay, so that was 1936. How well does that abstract idea hold up against, you know, the super fast processors and GPUs we have on our desks right now?
Amazingly well when you're talking about the fundamental limits. Now, obviously, real-world machines are more complex. We model them as random access machines, or RAM machines, which can jump to any memory location instantly.
Which a Turing machine can't. It has to chug along the tape one square at a time.
Right. But here's the crucial link, and it's a bit technical. RAM machines are what we call polynomially equivalent Turing machines.
Okay, let's unpack that. Polynomially equivalent. That's why the TM is still the gold standard in computer science theory, right?
It is. It means that if a problem can be solved by a TM in a time that's a polynomial function of its input size, like, say, n squared or n cubed steps, then a RAM machine can also solve it in polynomial time and vice versa.
So they might differ in actual speed, but they belong to the same complexity class. They draw the line between what's considered efficiently solvable and what's computationally hard in the exact same place.
Precisely. They define the same class of tractable problems. That's the famous P versus NP landscape. So even though a RAM machine is a more realistic model, for the big questions about the fundamental boundaries of computation, the theoretical power of the TM is identical to our most advanced hardware. The 1936 model still defines the entire landscape of efficiency.
That's just incredible. So we have the machine. Now we need the thesis that connects that abstract machine to our, you know, real-world idea of what it means to calculate something. And that's the Church-Turing thesis.
Right, developed around the same time by both Alonzo Church and Alan Turing, working independently.
And the thesis is basically the bridge between our human intuition and formal mathematics.
It is. It makes a very bold claim. It says that any function that is effectively calculable, meaning you can solve it with a step-by-step mechanical process, is also a Turing-computable function.
Okay, that phrase, effectively calculable, sounds technical, but it's really just a common sense idea of what an algorithm is. Can you break that down for us?
Yeah, just think of a recipe or instructions for assembling furniture. An effective procedure, an algorithm, has to follow a few simple rules.
Like what?
One, it's got to be finite. A finite set of instructions, and the whole process has to stop after a finite number of steps. Two, it has to be deterministic. The instructions have to be completely unambiguous. At every step, there's only one possible thing to do next.
Okay, and the third one is the most important, right?
It is. The process must be purely mechanical. It has to demand zero insight, zero ingenuity, zero creativity from the person or machine doing it. It has to be completely rote.
Mindless. The calculation works or fails because of the rules, not because of the intelligence of the operator.
Exactly. And that leads to the central puzzle. If this thesis is the absolute foundation of computer science, why do we always hear that it cannot be formally proven?
Right. Because you're trying to link a rigorously defined mathematical object, a Turing machine, to an informal, intuitive human idea, effective calculability.
You can't use formal math to prove something that's defined in natural language. We can prove that if something is Turing computable, it definitely fits our intuitive idea of an algorithm. But we can't prove the other way around. We can't prove that there isn't some weird, totally different method of effective calculation out there that we haven't discovered yet that doesn't fit the TM model.
So we accept the thesis not because of a proof, but because of just overwhelming evidence.
Yes. And that evidence was really this incredible historical confluence in the 1930s. It was a time of crisis in math. And so you had these three giants all working with completely different formal systems to try and pin down what computation really meant.
You had Church with his lambda calculus.
Jay Gödel with his generalized recursive functions and Turing with his machine model.
And the amazing discovery was that all three of these totally different approaches, one based on function abstraction, one on numerical recursion, and one on this physical machine analogy, they all ended up defining the exact same class of functions.
They were extensionally equivalent. And that consensus was incredibly powerful evidence. It made everyone think, okay, we've probably stumbled upon some natural fundamental boundary here. #tech2.2 Turing's argument and the limits of the human mind.
So let's go back to Turing's specific method, that cognitive approach. The real power of his argument for the thesis is that his formal model, the TM, came from analyzing the limits of a human computer, right?
That's the core insight. The thesis really stands on those boundedness conditions we talked about, finite observable symbols, finite states of mind. If you accept that those are real constraints on any human carrying out a rote calculation,
then the Turing machine has to be able to simulate it.
It has to. I mean, what if a mathematician could suddenly, I don't know, process an infinite number of symbols all at once or had access to an infinite number of distinct mental states?
Then the whole model falls apart.
The whole analysis fails. The thesis is really an assertion about what's possible for mechanisms that operate within those physical, human-like boundaries. And since Turing's time, every new model of computation that's been proposed, supercomputers, parallel processing, you name it, has been shown to fall within the scope of what a TM can simulate.
It might be much, much slower, but it can do it.
Right, often with just what's called a polynomial overhead. So the thesis really acts as this permanent limit marker. It defines the absolute ceiling on what any step-by-step mechanical rule-following process can ever achieve.
Which is a huge deal. It means the theoretical limit of calculation, which was defined almost 90 years ago, has never been breached.
And that includes quantum computers.
Right, I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, even quantum computers, which use superposition and entanglement to solve certain problems way faster, are still generally believed to be covered by what's called the strong Church-Turing thesis.
Which says what?
That any physically realizable computation can be simulated efficiently by a Turing machine. Now, there's some debate there, but fundamentally, the class of problems a quantum computer can solve is still thought to be the same as what a classical TM can solve. It just gets to the answer faster for some specific problems.
So the thesis seems to be this incredibly profound claim about information itself. It suggests that all mechanical information processing, whether it's happening in silicon or in our brains or with quantum particles, is fundamentally the same in its intrinsic power. Okay, so if the Turing machine defines what can be computed, the next logical step, and the really mind-bending one, is to define what cannot be. And this brings us to what's been called the great defeat of rationalism in the 20th century.
Starting with David Hilbert's challenge.
The Entscheidungs problem.
The decision problem. Yeah, this was the absolute centerpiece of Hilbert's program to formalize all of mathematics. He asked a simple sounding question. Is there a general mechanical effective method, an algorithm that can take any formula in first order logic and tell you yes or no, whether that formula is provable?
His ambition was just massive. He wanted a version of mathematics with no ignorabimus, no we shall not know. He wanted an algorithm that could just churn out mathematical truth.
The ultimate dream of certain formalized knowledge. But in 1936, Turing and Church, again, independently, proved that this dream was impossible. They showed that first-order logic is undecidable. There is no such general algorithm.
Okay, that's a huge abstract conclusion. How did Turing connect that back to his nuts and bolts gate machine?
It's just a beautiful piece of logic. He didn't attack the problem head-on. Instead, he showed that if you could solve the Entscheidungs problem, you could use that solution as a kind of subroutine to solve a very specific problem about his own machines.
And what was that specific machine problem?
The problem of determining whether any given Turing machine M will ever print the symbol zero.
So he created a chain. If you can solve A, the logic problem, you can solve B, the print zero problem. So if you can prove B is impossible,
then A must be impossible too, because you can't have a computable result that depends on an uncomputable premise. And that impossibility, that the print zero problem was unsolvable, became the direct stepping stone to the most famous example of all.
The halting problem. #tag3.2. The halting problem, HP. Right. The halting problem is sort of the computational cousin of the Entscheidungs problem. Let's just state it as clearly as we can. What is the halting problem?
The halting problem is the question of whether a perfect universal algorithm can exist, a decider, that can take any computer program and its input and tell you with certainty if that program will eventually finish its job and halt, or if it will get stuck in an infinite loop and run forever.
And we should be clear, we're not talking about practical limits, like your computer running out of memory or you not wanting to wait a million years. This is a question of pure logic. In infinite time and with infinite memory, does the process have to stop?
Precisely. And Turing proved the answer is no. No such universal decider can exist. The proof is this classic, beautiful proof by contradiction, a reductio ad absurdum. It uses self-reference in the same way Cantor's diagonal argument does.
Okay, let's walk through it, because this is the moment the theoretical barrier gets built. We start with a big paradoxical assumption.
Right. Step one, assume that perfect decider exists. Let's call it a function, a dollar. It takes a program tau dollars and its input I dollars. If particle halts on dollar says true, if paddle loops on a dollar says false, and crucially, dollar itself always halts and gives an answer.
So we have our magical halting detector. Now we build a very mischievous program to trick it.
We construct a new program. Let's call it paradox. This program takes the description of another program, let's call it p-test, as its only input. Now, inside paradox, it calls our magic decider dollars dollars, but it asks it a very specific self-referential question.
It asks, does test halt when you feed it its own description as input? So it asks us about HP test.
Exactly. And here's the trap. The code for paradox is written to do the exact opposite of whatever dollar predicts. If dollar says yes, dollars will halt, then paradox deliberately enters an infinite loop. If number says no, dollar is going to loop forever, then paradox immediately halts.
And the final fatal move is to feed paradox its own description. We ask, what happens when we run paradox?
The whole system collapses into a paradox. Let's trace it. If we assume paradox halts when run on itself, well, according to its own code, that can only happen if dollars predicted it would loop.
And if we assume paradox loops forever,
then according to its code, that can only happen if no dollar predicted it would halt.
It's impossible. It has to halt and loop at the same time. And since that can't happen, our original assumption that this perfect decider dollar could even exist must be false.
And that's it. The halting problem is undecidable, a permanent, uncrossable boundary for all algorithms, no matter how fast or powerful the computer is.
So what's the real-world takeaway for, say, a programmer listening to this? Why does the 1936 limit matter today?
Oh, it's everywhere. It's the reason you can never write a perfect universal debugging tool that can look at any piece of code and guarantee it will find all potential infinite loops before you run it.
You can write good ones for specific cases, but never a foolproof one for all code.
Never. It's also why you can't write a perfect antivirus program that can guarantee it will spot every possible virus that tries to crash your system with an infinite loop. The undecidability of the halting problem is the deep reason why software verification, in its most general form, is an intractable problem.
And the depth of this is shown by things like Chaitin's halting probability, this number omega. What is that?
Omega is this fascinating mathematical constant. It's defined as the probability that a randomly generated program of a specific type will eventually halt. It's a single, well-defined, real number, like pi, but for computation.
But the incredible irony is that you can't actually compute it.
You can't. You can find approximations for the first few digits, but no algorithm can ever produce the entire infinite sequence of digits of omega. If you could, you could solve the halting problem. It's a number that is defined, but fundamentally unknowable. It encodes infinite, unprovable mathematical truths in its digits. Hashtag tag 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 3.3, the Gödel-Halting connection.
The self-referential nature of the halting problem proof sounds so much like what Kurt Gödel found in formal mathematics just a few years earlier. How do these two great limitations of the 20th century connect?
They're really two sides of the same coin. They're twin stars of undecidability, and the proofs even have the same diagonal structure. Gödel showed there are limits to formal systems of proof.
Right. He showed that in any system powerful enough for arithmetic, there will always be statements that are true, but you can't prove them within that system.
A formal system can't capture all of truth, and the halting problem establishes the exact same kind of limit on formal systems of computation. One is about what can be proven, the other is about what can be solved.
So how does the halting problem give you Gödel's result as a consequence?
Well, you can get a weaker form of Gödel's first incompleteness theorem pretty easily from it. The theorem says you can't have an axiomatic system for numbers that is both complete and sound.
And complete means every true statement is provable, and sound means only true statements are provable.
Correct. Now, just imagine for a second that you did have such a system, a complete and sound system for arithmetic.
Okay.
You could then, in theory, write a computer program that would just start searching for a proof of any statement you give it. If the statement is true, because the system is complete, your program would eventually find the proof and halt. If the statement is false, because the system is sound, it would find a proof of its negation and halt.
And you could use that proof-finding program to solve the halting problem.
Exactly. For any program styles and input of dollars, the statement program halts on input dollar is just a statement about numbers. It's either true or false. If you had a complete and sound system, your proof-finder program could solve it. But we know the halting problem is undecidable. Therefore, no such complete and sound axiomatic system can exist.
The limits on computation directly cause the limits on proof. Wow. These aren't just quirks of technology. They are woven into the very fabric of logic and math. Okay, so if the Church-Turing thesis draws this absolute line in the sand for what an algorithm can do, the next obvious question is, can we cheat? Can we find a way to perform super-Turing computation?
This is where we get into some really fun speculative territory. The success of the thesis led to what's called the physical Church-Turing thesis.
Which basically says what the thesis says, but applies it to the whole universe.
Right. It claims that all physically computable functions are Turing computable. If that's true, then these limits aren't just mathematical ideas, they're fundamental laws of physics.
But the only way to challenge that is to imagine a physical system that somehow breaks Turing's rules. Like, for instance, the rule that every step takes some amount of time.
And that leads to the most famous theoretical idea here, accelerated Turing machines, or ATMs, sometimes called hypercomputation. These are purely conceptual machines that violate our understanding of physics, but they show how you could bypass the limit.
How does an accelerated Turing machine work?
It breaks the time constraint. A normal TM takes a fixed amount of time for each step. An ATM performs an infinite number of operations in a finite amount of time because it speeds up with every step.
So the first step takes half a second, the next a quarter of a second, the next an eighth, and so on.
And the total time for an infinite number of steps is the sum of that series, which converges to 1 second. After 1 second, it has completed an infinite task.
And what can a machine like that compute?
It can compute the uncomputable. It can solve the halting problem.
Okay, walk me through that. How does an ATM solve the halting problem in 1 second?
It's pretty clever. So the ATM wants to know if the nth Turing machine halts. It starts by writing zero on a special answer square. Then it begins to simulate the nth machine. It does the first step in half a second, the second step in a quarter second, and so on. If at any point during that infinite simulation, the nth machine halts, the ATM immediately stops, erases the zero and writes a one. If the nth machine never halts, the simulation just runs forever, but the whole thing is over in 1 second and the zero is left untouched. So after 1 second has passed, you just look at the answer square.
And it will have the correct answer to the halting problem. It's a mind-bending.
It is. And what it tells us is that the boundary of computation isn't just a matter of pure logic. It's a matter of physics. If the laws of our universe somehow allowed for that kind of infinite speed up, the Church-Turing thesis would be broken.
And this isn't just philosophy anymore. There are results from actual physics that are starting to bump up against this boundary.
Exactly. There's been recent work in condensed matter physics on something called the spectral gap problem.
What's that?
It's about determining if a complex quantum system has an energy gap above its ground state. It's a fundamental question. And recently, researchers proved that this problem is formally undecidable.
So a problem that comes directly from the laws of physics can't be solved by a Turing machine.
It's even more than that. It's been shown to be at least as hard as solving the halting problem. And what's really shocking is that this uncomputability emerges even though the equations governing the system are themselves perfectly computable. It suggests uncomputability might not just be a mathematical abstraction. It might be physically embedded in the behavior of reality itself. #tag 4.2 philosophical implications for mind and AI.
So given that the whole Turing machine model started by analyzing a human computer, it's no surprise that these limits have huge implications for cognitive science. Turing is seen as a founding father of that field, right?
Oh, absolutely. He had this theory that the cortex at birth is a kind of unorganized machine, maybe even a universal one, that gets trained by experience into the adult mind. And that idea laid the groundwork for what became the dominant theory of the 20th century, the computational theory of mind, or CTM.
And CTM is the idea that thinking, believing, all of it. It's just computation. The mind is the software running on the brain's hardware.
Right.
The theory models mental processes as rule-governed symbol manipulation. The flow of thought is just a series of deterministic steps, just like a Turing machine.
Which immediately leads to the biggest question of all. Is the human mind only a Turing machine? Is our consciousness just an algorithm?
And that remains probably the biggest open question in philosophy and science. Many thinkers have pushed back hard against that reductive view. They argue that high-level human thought has properties that just don't fit into the Turing-style model.
Can you give an example?
Sure. The philosopher Jerry Fodor was a big critic. He focused on things like abductive reasoning. That's the process of figuring out the best possible explanation for something you observe.
Like a doctor diagnosing a patient or a detective solving a crime.
Exactly. And Fodor argued that Turing-style computation is only sensitive to local properties, the identity and order of the symbols right in front of it. A TM just follows rules based on what it sees in its immediate little window.
But human reasoning feels bigger than that, more holistic. That's his point. Abductive reasoning is sensitive to non-local properties, things like relevance or simplicity, or how well a new idea fits with everything else you already believe. These global judgments are crucial for deciding which explanation is the best one. And since it's incredibly hard to define something as fuzzy as relevance in the strict, local, step-by-step rules of a Turing machine, Fodor argued the CTM might fail to capture what makes us truly intelligent.
So if our minds really do operate on these global, fluid concepts, then our most complex thoughts might actually be happening outside the strict confines of Turing computability.
That's the argument. And that takes us right to the Turing test. The test itself, you know, measuring if a machine can act indistinguishably from a human, it connects all these theoretical limits to our own emotional response to a machine.
Turing's idea of intelligence was really unusual. It was almost a social definition, not a technical one.
It was. He wrote that intelligence is an emotional concept, and that whether we think something is intelligent is determined as much by our own state of mind as by the properties of the object.
So it's not about what the machine is, it's about how it makes us feel. If its program is complex enough to surprise us or convince us, we just decide to call it intelligent.
Exactly. The Turing test isn't really measuring if a machine has broken the TM limit. It's measuring our perception. And it suggests that when we hit these computational limits, we're forced to ask a really hard question about ourselves. Is our own intelligence genuinely non-mechanical, or does it just feel that way because the algorithm is so complex that we can't see the gears turning? The limits of the machine become a mirror for the limits of our own understanding. #tag outro.
So we started this deep dive with the simplest possible definition of a computer, a tape, a reader, a few rules, the Turing machine. And we found that from that simple model, these profound, unshakable barriers emerged.
Yeah, the undecidability of the Entscheidungs problem and, of course, the halting problem. And those discoveries really cemented the Church-Turing thesis. They established this fundamental boundary on what any effective mechanical step-by-step procedure can do.
And that boundary is still solid. It defines the core capabilities of all of our technology, from supercomputers to quantum computers.
The speed has gone up exponentially, but the kind of computation is still constrained by that logic from 1936. But, you know, to leave you with a final thought, let's circle back to those philosophical frontiers.
All right.
We mentioned that computability doesn't even really apply to real numbers because you can't represent them finitely. And we've seen that physicists are starting to find uncomputability embedded in the laws of quantum mechanics itself.
And we know that the only theoretical way to break the Church-Turing limit is with something like hypercomputation performing infinite steps in finite time.
Yeah.
So given that our deepest human experiences, like creativity or free will, feel like processes that defy any simple deterministic step-by-step explanation.
Does that mean that true intelligence, or maybe true understanding of the universe, requires processes that must, by their very nature, lie outside the strict, finite, deterministic world of Turing computability? If everything that's predictable is computable, maybe the truly innovative, the truly new, the truly unknown has to be something more.